Up until the 1960s and 70s, there had been few, if any, human beings who were forced to live their lives under such intense media scrutiny as John F. Kennedy Jr. did. Born in 1960, at the dawn of the television era, his father, a master of the new medium, used his young family to project a false but highly attractive image of himself as a wholesome family man. President Kennedy's assassination increased public pressure on John, even though he was only a young boy. The salute by that little boy in blue at his father's casket cemented the belief that John would be the natural heir to his father's legacy. America's Reluctant Prince is a biography of JFK Jr. by Stephen Gillen, scholar in residence at the History Channel and professor of history at the University of Oklahoma. The name of the book is America's Reluctant Prince, The Life of John F. Kennedy Jr. It is published by Dutton, and a pleasure to welcome Stephen to the program this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm on this morning.
Very nice to have you. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yep, you are. It's
excellent.
Just Gillen.
Gillen, excellent. So a couple of things. First of all, tell me about the nature of the friendship, how you met this man.
So I met John at Brown University in 1981. I was a graduate student getting a PhD in American civilization, and I was a teaching assistant in a class in modern American political history, and John enrolled in the class, and he signed up for my discussion section. So that's where I first met him, and that was his sophomore year, but it wasn't really until his senior year that we started hanging out more. We worked out together. We used to play racquetball, some vicious games of racquetball, and then we'd spend a lot of time just sitting around and talking, and then we stayed in touch when I was for the next 18 years or so, and I worked with him at George. I used to write some of his speeches, and I talked to him the Tuesday before he died.
What was it about the time that has passed since his death that you decided that you wanted to write a biography?
So, like many of his close friends, I protected John's privacy when he was alive. But now, as his friend and also as an historian, I feel it's my responsibility to preserve his legacy. I don't want John to be remembered as the hunk flunks or as the sexiest man alive. The John I knew was far more complicated and had many more dimensions to his personality. And that's the John I wanted to capture and the John I want the world to know.
When did you, in your friendship with him, did you start to get a sense of who he really was?
That's a great question. You know, the problem with John isn't – John always knew who he was. The problem was getting through all that stuff that surrounds him and understanding him just as John. You know, John told me he was two people, that he was just John, another privileged member of his generation, but he had a role to play in life. And that role was John Fitzgerald Kennedy Jr., the son of beloved slain president. And the challenge for me was to look beyond the John F. Kennedy Jr. and just accept John for who he was. And that was easy to do when in private, but when you're in public, you're constantly reminded of who John is by the way people treat him, the way people stop and stare, the way they walk into telephone poles. But it was pretty early on that I came to know that the John, the real John, and the authentic John.
What was what was his relationship with his mother? Because it was a complex relationship.
It was complicated, but they had a very loving relationship. Now, his mom was really the first helicopter mom before that term was even coined. And she understood that John had a short attention span, that he could be absent-minded. So she reached out to her large circle of friends, and she was constantly putting them in touch with John so that they could guide him in certain ways. So, you know, if John was looking for an internship, she would contact a friend who would offer John an internship. She wanted it so that John believed he was getting these things on his own, where in fact she was getting them for him. And the other thing that he had, and his mom sort of shared, he had the same view of the paparazzi. So they both complained about the paparazzi, but they also were disappointed when they weren't in the media. So John whenever John went a couple weeks and he wasn't on Page Six or somewhere else, I can guarantee you John would organize a touch football game in Central Park, regardless of the weather, and he'd play with his shirt off.
And the idea was he knew that that would make the papers.
That's exactly right. I used to call him a reverse Superman. That, you know, Superman goes into a phone booth and puts his uniform on. John goes into a phone booth and takes his shirt off. But that was his, that's how he knew he would get attention. He knew his, and we used to play, and you could just see in the distance all these photographers with all these powerful lenses. So John wanted to stay in the news, and being there with his shirt off was one of the best ways of doing it.
And then you're not under scrutiny other than by that camera lens. In other words, if he wanted to, he could have walked into any newsroom in the country and say, interview me.
That's right. No, that's right. But John, you know, John wanted to maintain at least the appearance of privacy. And he knew that the questions that he would get would all be about his father, about what his legacy is and when he was going into politics. And he just did not want to answer those questions. He had lunch one time with a friend, and the friend remarked how everybody was staring at him, at John. And he said, that must be odd for you. You don't know anybody here. They all know who you are. And John said, that's not the odd part. For me, the odd part is that they remember and I don't. So John had very few memories of his father, and he was afraid that these interviews would all go to a space where he just wasn't comfortable going.
When it comes to what he was destined to do, you spoke a moment ago of his mother's influence in helping him get some of these opportunities. What was it, did you get a sense that he really wanted to do, of what he wanted to do with his life?
For a long time, he didn't know. John did not want to go into politics unless he knew he had a calling. He did not want to just go into the family business. So he spent a lot of time, you know, up until he created George Magazine, I think he was just trying to see if he really did want to go into politics. By the time he starts George Magazine, I mean, George is really his way of getting involved in the political discussion or political debate. But it's really not until the last 2 years of his life that John realizes that he has a calling to get into politics. And I had this conversation with him one time, and he had spent the afternoon ice skating in Harlem with underprivileged kids, and they were all hanging on to him. That night he was describing it to me, and he said, what these kids need is hope. They need to know that tomorrow is going to be better than today. There's a long pause, and he says, I can give them that hope. I can provide that hope. And that's when I realized that he had turned the corner, and he was no longer the reluctant prince. He was a prince who was looking for his opportunity to get into politics.
He was toying with the idea of running for office. Did you get a sense of what he wanted to, of what office he was seeking and what his ultimate goal was?
His ultimate goal was the White House. John would always make comments about wanting to go home. I think John, when he realized he wanted to go into politics, it was really for one reason. That was to go back and become president. So he was in the last night of his life, he was talking about running for governor of New York against George Pataki. I think the race was 2002. And then eventually running for president. So whether that would have happened or not, John had a lot of issues he had to work through. His magazine was failing. His relationship with his wife was in a bad place. His best friend and cousin Anthony Roswell was dying. So he had a lot of stuff he had to work through before he could run for office. But there was no doubt that he wanted to be president.
He was having problems, personal problems with his sister as well.
That's right. I mean, they had a long, loving, and respectful relationship. I mean, no one else could understand the life that they lived. But this often happens, you know, when you get married, things get more complicated. And John did not like Caroline's husband, Ed. There was just a clash of personalities. And there were a number of things that happened, especially the auction of their mother's estate. Mrs. Voss's estate, that really created a lot of tension with John and Ed and John and Caroline. And But I'll say that the day before John died, he called Caroline and told her that they talked about doing a better job of staying in touch. So they had a really loving conversation that last day, and I think they were definitely on the way to mend whatever differences they had.
Do you think that in some way there was, as much as was possible, that there was some closure there then?
I do. I mean, this John was going to have ongoing problems with Ed. He just didn't like him. And Ed and Caroline didn't care for Carolyn. So there was always going to be that tension. But I think John and Caroline were determined not to allow that to get in the way of their relationship.
When you think of this, we talk about relationships. So let's talk about the relationship with his wife. And you write in the book that in the final days of his life that he told close friends, I don't know if that includes you or not, of his plans to separate from his wife.
That's right. So the relationship, the biggest problem in the relationship were the paparazzi. That John and Carolyn both naively believed that the paparazzi would go away once John's married, because he's no longer the most eligible bachelor in America. But just the opposite happens, and the paparazzi become much more aggressive, and they made life miserable for Carolyn, who took out a lot of her frustrations on John. So the relationship was really spiraling out of control. That last year, John spoke to some of his friends about getting a divorce, not me, but other friends about getting a divorce. In that last week, he called a close friend, a confidant, that he was going to separate from Carolyn. But, you know, Carolyn's decision to get on that plane on that Friday was, I think, an important step. She was not going to go to the wedding. And that's why John was really upset with her, and why he was staying at this, one of the reasons why he was staying at the Stanhope. But she decided to go at the last minute. So even there, just like with Caroline, there are sort of gestures at the end that suggest they're both trying to work things out. And one of John's friends told me, and I think it's absolutely true, he said, if anyone tells you they know what was going to happen in that relationship, they're lying, because John and Carolyn didn't know what was going to happen in that relationship.
He's so young when he dies, and obviously it's a jolt because of his youth, but also because of the series of family tragedies. What was the reaction, the immediate reaction for you and amongst his friends?
I think it was just shock, disbelief. You know, John was such a powerful presence, physically, emotionally, in all of our lives. That, I mean, John was the most powerful person I ever met. Powerful, not that his name or his family, just physically powerful and emotionally strong. But it's just inconceivable to me that he would be gone. That week, between the time that the plane crashed and memorial service on Friday, we were gathering. There were little gatherings taking place in apartments in New York, and we were just all shocked. We just could not believe that John was gone. I think we felt the same way most of America did. And it was the saddest week of my life.
You attended the memorial service, which was relatively small, 350 people.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Unbearably sad. I sat next to Senator John Kerry, future Secretary of State Kerry, and he cried his eyes out through the entire service. And I remember thinking, I'd be doing the same thing, but I had no tears left because I had been crying all week. And for me, the most memorable moment for me wasn't at the service. It was when we left the service, we had a walk to the Sacred Heart Convent, which is a few blocks away, for a reception. And it was a hot, humid day, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people standing out there honoring John and his memory. And I just remember, I had been so wallowing in my own grief, I forgot who John was and what he represented to the nation. I just knew of my own loss. And as I was walking toward the convent, I saw all these people. And I remember thinking to myself, yep, you really were special. You really were special.
Stephen Gillen is the author of the new book, America's Reluctant Prince, The Life of John F. Kennedy Jr. There's also a corresponding documentary with A&E, which is based on the book and features Stephen. It is called JFK Jr., The Final Years. It will premiere on July 16th, which is the 20th anniversary of JFK Jr.'s death. And again, the name of the new book is America's Reluctant Prince. It is published by Dutton. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure. I enjoyed the conversation.
Be well. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.